Venerable Vipassi took some pictures of my Rolls Royce meditation path. So I want to show off, and we're going to show you now. Here you go. It's on there. Can you see it there? You press that? There you go. There he goes.
Wow.
Pretty cool, huh?
Yes.
I mean, it's cool. Look at that. It's a Rolls Royce. Made for liberation. Okay. So what are we doing? We're doing morning, aren't we? You're doing morning, I'm doing evening. We had the interviews, which is lovely to hear people's reflections. And I'm glad these ideas are helpful, obviously. As a teacher, you never quite know how what part of one's expression is effective. So getting feedback about what works and what doesn't work is very helpful for a teacher. So I'm gratified that there are happy customers. it makes my life worthwhile. My mind is blank. It's very interesting teaching in the way Lompo Cha taught us to teach, because I really, when I begin the retreat, I have nothing to say. In the middle, I have nothing to say. In the end, I have nothing to say. But somehow, something gets said. So it's rather magical, really. But what I thought I'd perhaps in this meditation, consider what in the Zen tradition, I think they called, I won't go into foreign languages, I'm not good in foreign languages, but we call it in English choiceless awareness. And it's a very good practice. And go back. Some people find breath meditation, they get tense. There's something about observing the breathing, they get into a kind of a holding, controlling mode, and they find an they don't find it effective. But then they're reflective people. And so I said, well, why don't you try opening your mind to what we call choiceless awareness? They find that effective. Some people, choiceless awareness, they get a bit too lost in it, too much space. So they need reference to an object. But having a kind of combination of possibilities is very, very useful. So I think the whole, like metta bhavana, you know, having ways of doing that is very important. And there's so many different ways that people practice that. But the basic attitude of welcoming and being with the softness of the heart, this is very, very helpful, because that kind of attitude, you can sustain that for a long time. You can sustain a kind of kind, welcoming attitude for a long time. Just willpower, you can't sustain so long. Because it's beautiful, metta is beautiful. So do consider that in your kind of, in the patterns of practice you like to do. It doesn't have to be the same pattern every time, but certainly in classical sort of Theravada descriptions of meditation, usually you begin with some reference to the Buddha by bowing, by chanting Itipiso, or whatever you want, Arahang. And so your references to the Buddha, you could do it to the Buddha as person, but also add to the Buddha who, you know, as possibility to enlightenment itself, because this is a very optimistic teaching, although it's methodology is the contemplation, to some extent, of suffering, and its methodology in living is the contemplation of goodness. You'd think if it was about suffering, it's just about some kind of existential problem we have. But actually, the Buddha's enlightenment is an optimistic statement about our human capacity, that we can, you know, if we're reflective, we can realize profound insights and profound peace. So when you look at a Buddha, and you have Thai culture, so you're very lucky, you have a lot of faith and you know, a lot of sadha in your culture. So when you look at a Buddha image, what I try to do is I try to remember the being, but more importantly, remember the optimism that enlightenment presents to me. It says there is this human possibility, which is a beautiful contrast to the, you know, the horrible things one hears in the news, that the planet is, you know, going to end, you know, our human life is going to end soon, and politics, you know, that human beings look pretty pathetic, actually. So that's the only thing you see, you know, but the Buddha is like the human potential, enlightenment and goodness. So I have friends now keep giving me Buddha rupas. So I have Buddha rupas all in my room. They're just gorgeous. They're just gorgeous. And it's just lovely to sit there and just, like, I get given a lot of things. This is when you're a lone paw, this happens. So one of the things, I get given little animals, maybe because I'm 74. I don't get stuffed animals yet. They're not teddy bears, but I get a little turtle and a little duck and a little pig. So what I do, and I have one Buddha by my computer. So I have the turtle looking at me and the duck looking at me and the pig looking at me. And I have Lopa Cha looking at me. And then I have the Buddha image, and the Buddha image is looking inwards. And I like that. I like the way the Buddha image, it's not looking out. It's not, you know, it's not looking out into the sense world. It's knowing. And that's the I like that kind of imagery where the Buddha's gaze isn't kind of looking out at the world. The gaze is kind of inwards, and being the knowing, as it were. And that to me is the idea of awakened consciousness. And then the pig and the duck and all these guys, they're my good friends. So I have, you know, I have lovely imagery. And Buddhism has this beautiful iconography that you can use that to, you know, when you just gaze at something like a beautiful image and you let it come to you, then that receptive quality, and you have faith, you know, that imbues the mind with a sense of happiness. And those are the foundations for meditation, like metta bhavana, sadha, right? That kind of faith in this. It's an optimism. And those can be done. They don't have to be done as an intellectual exercise. They can be done as more like a devotional exercise, like bhakti in the Indian tradition. So one of our monks, Venerable Amar Siri, comes from a very sort of bhakti background. And you can see how his chanting and his relationship to iconography brings him a lot of joy. And so he's a very, he's wonderful to be with because he reminds us of that bhakti quality. And I mean, I have that too. So if you introduce your meditation in that way, you know, there's no rush. You're not getting, it's not like you have to sit down and write 10 emails. It's not the same business. It's not you're trying to get your meditation finished so you can cook your meal. You know, it's like entering into a space of non-becoming, not getting something finished, going nowhere, that kind of strange language. And so calmly using your shrine, lighting the candles, preparing the flowers, bowing three times. This brings beauty and aspiration and many good qualities into the heart. And that's a preparation, isn't it? It prepares the ground for meditation. And then usually classical Buddhism would say then to do metta bhavana, think gratitude, Katanyakatavedi, to your teachers, and then metta to all sentient beings. And then that brings happiness to the heart. Huh? And then when you enter into, and when you choose an object of meditation from that perspective, there's all those wholesome qualities. Where sometimes, I know people, like people who come from Western backgrounds, sometimes they don't have that whole culture of faith and sada, and it becomes sometimes a bit dry with technique, which is okay. But these heart qualities are wonderful. And I certainly learned that in Thailand. The faith that Thai people had, and the Chauban and Ubon who would come with faith, and they're very inspiring. And like in the all-night sittings, the women, the village women whose kids were kind of running the farm, they could come and stay all night. They were fantastic meditators, very, very, very impressive. So those things are an important part of technique, I would say, you know, because technique can be very, very dry. It's not so much technique, it's almost lifestyle. So then in developing meditation, part of what you have to bear with is the vipaka kama of the day's experiences. So if you meditate in the evening, you have to give yourself space for any conflicts which arose in the day. They will come up. So if you had a really difficult business meeting and one of the, you know, a few of the people were argumentative, or you get accused of something or whatever, your heart feels that, and because you're a civilized person, you don't act it out, but you do feel it. So then you come home to the meditation. You have to recognize that this material is going to come up now as physical tension, but basically as storyline. And if you give yourself a chance to just allow the mind to release that by knowing the body, knowing emotions, and not running with the storyline, not running with the narrative, not running with the thinking. And this is the balance between repression and indulgence. Indulgence would be running with the, oh, they shouldn't have said that, and I shouldn't have said that. That's the storyline. That's the atavada. That's the self-view. That's the papancha, prungdeng. Repression would be taking your object of meditation and just trying to make your mind peaceful and not have that material come into consciousness. And that would be kind of, it wouldn't give a good effect, because you still, vipaka kama still has a kind of life of its own. So let's say I was in a business meeting and someone was talking and I felt really annoyed at the person, because I thought what they were saying was unfair or unkind, maybe they're for whatever reason. And I was with that annoyance. I wasn't aware of that annoyance. And I just kept thinking, why do they say that? Why do they say that? Why do they say that? Under my breath, not in the meeting. That creates the kamma, right? For having that later on in my meditation. So it's important to do some period of like purification if you can at the end of the day. And if you do that and you don't go to the storyline, then you release that stuff and your mind has balance and it has a chance to go to the more refined things of life. So evening meditation can be difficult because you may be wound up or you're maybe tired, but it's very fruitful to just feel what happened today. Barring that, it will come up in your dream states quite often. You know, that's the way the dream world seems to process things. And then in the morning, if there is material kind of left over, you'll find that, won't you? That if you're really worried about someone in the families, maybe their health or something like that, that worry will be there in the morning, because that's part of what your mind has been considering. And then it's like I said, it's very important to really notice what's going on. What's the mood of the mind? Really do awaken to what is going on, because you get a really good chance to see, oh, my mind's really carrying this before it gets reborn into self. So morning meditations are, I think, paramount, because in the morning, that sense of ego hasn't really sort of grabbed hold yet. You haven't really engaged with your emails and with the problems that, you face in the day. And so you can see, or at least I find that, I can see the formation of whatever beginning to arise. I can see it in a more pure form before it goes into thought. And if you are attentive to it, it doesn't grab hold. It doesn't get reborn into consciousness. And you can really dwell in the silence of the mind, into the compassion of the heart. So if you, again, you know, life is busy and maybe you're very tired, but morning meditation is very helpful, very, very, very fruitful. So if you can wake up before the rest of the family, if you get a reputation for being boring, I go to sleep at 9 o'clock. Oh, she's boring or he's boring. Good. Rather than being a party animal, and you get a reputation for going to sleep early and everyone knows, then you can get up early. No one else is awake, right? And don't look at your emails. Don't look at the news. And use that, you know, before the world starts, as it were. It's a beautiful time to meditate. And a retreat helps you, you know, develop that pattern. So those two ends of the day, as it were, the beginning and end, are fabulous times. Probably the evening meditation is the more difficult because you're tired. And so sometimes the yoga nidra posture, many people find they don't really want to sit because they're tired from a day's work. But they find that they can lie down and actually they're not sleepy. Their minds are kind of very active. So then the lying posture becomes a really good way of resting. The body feels rested, but the mind having enough brightness to not get caught into whatever and touch the silence of the mind. And then again, as I was saying, if during sleep you wake up 2 in the morning, right away don't believe in the worry mind. Oh, I have to get my sleep. I have to get my 8 hours sleep. Get in yoga nidra, get in savasana posture, and say, okay, if I fall asleep, fine. But in the meantime, penyang niyang. And you can be quite, you know, the body, it's interesting. The body can have deep rest and you can still be aware. It's a very interesting kind of investigation. So then having prepared the meditation, you having done puja, having done metta bhavana, then you usually make a choice, don't you? But the first choice is always to establish the profundity of awakened consciousness before you jump into a technique, because that's what it's all about. It's to remember that. And then from that, you say, okay, what would I like to experiment with? What kind of meditation would I like to experiment and sustain to awaken consciousness? That's what I think helps. And then you make a choice, and it might be, well, what I'd like to just, maybe we could do that, is this idea of shikantaza in Japanese. I think I got it right. Or choiceless awareness. Is that sound right? Yeah? One of the venerables can speak a bit of Japanese. So shikantaza, from what I remember, is choiceless awareness. But you do make a choice. And the choice is awakened awareness. But the choiceless part of it is not to need any particular object, but use anicca sanya, the perception of change, as the theme, let us say, the theme of awareness. So it kind of refers to that, you know, when I say begin the meditation, listen to sound, notice the changing nature of sound, and be the witness, be the knowing of change. And that's choiceless in the sense is that you're not choosing an object. You're not choosing your breath or a particular part of the body or whatever. Now, different things will come up, and, you know, objects will come up. You might hear a sound. You might have a memory of something. You might get some pain in the shoulder, or you might smell something from the incense. So objects are coming and going. And the idea is that to be the witness, or witnessing itself, the awareness itself, as we like to say. And that is something some people really find it really is very, very helpful, because they've always been trying to hold on to an object and they find it really relaxes, and yet they can do that. In that openness, quite often you hear the sound of silence and then you experiment. But if you find you just go off into thinking, it's hard to stay in that pleasant moment, then you localize your attention, maybe the breath, or if you have some like really, really strong emotions coming up, you witness the emotions as change. So you have this kind of flexibility, but where you go beyond doubt is you know that the point of the exercise is awakened awareness. It's not to achieve anything, to understand anything. That's the point of the exercise. So you always have that first principle that you're working from, the sense of balance. And then you experiment. So, you know, teachers will give you all these different techniques and it can be confusing. Which technique should I use? Well, if you have the basic principle, the whole idea is awakened awareness, then most techniques are pretty good. You know, the teachers have to develop them in different ways. So in Tibetan tradition, you have a lot like visualization. I don't teach visualization because I can't do that. My mind doesn't do that. I don't visualize things. Artists sometimes use Asubha Gamatan. I don't do that because I found it was, for me, it led me to aversion. So I found Metta Bhavana was much, much more helpful. But that's just me. You know, some people. So you'll find in the Visuddhi Magga, you'll find, I think, 50 classic ways of developing meditation. And the last of the list, if I remember correctly, it's a long time since I read that, but the last one is just described as peace. It was interesting, which really, to me, I think is awakened consciousness or Nibbana or non-desire or whatever, but it's not described very much. Huh? And yet you could see in non-grasping or non-attachment or choiceless awareness, that's peaceful. And that's the meditation object, is peace. Again, you think, no, that's the goal. But when you abide as witness, non-desire, you see, oh, that's peaceful. And you just use that. Very, very simple. It's very, very simple. So let's you stretch your legs a bit if you want. I'll try that choiceless awareness with you, okay? Again, we'll meditate for 45 minutes. See how that goes. Knowing where you are and how the place feels, the simple entry into meditation. So the room, how does it feel just to be in this space that you're in? It doesn't have to be any special feeling. Just take something simple like temperature, like warmth or coolness. A very neutral kind of perception, temperature. And right away you have the silent knowing. So by attending to simple objects, you're reminded of the silent knowing. Again, sound. Whole body awareness. Perceive the bodily feelings in awareness. Feel the breathing in awareness. Listen to sound. Notice the changing nature of sound. Be the knowing of change. Feel the body. Notice the changing nature of bodily feelings. Be the knowing of the body in awareness. And notice both. You hear, you feel, you hear, you feel, back and forth. Be the knowing of change. Don't choose sound, don't choose the body, just let them manifest in whatever way. So, witnessing change. Now in this, what happens is you start to look for something. So the receptive quality is important. You're not looking for an objective experience. You are the witness of change. Now let's play around with this. Now localize your attention on the breathing. Make that central, other things will be there. Now localize your attention on the nostrils. Now localize your attention on the right nostril, on the left nostril, both nostrils. Now notice the temperature on the in-breath at the nostrils. And the temperature on the out-breath at the nostrils. Now notice, are your eyes squeezed? Is there pressure in your forehead? Now open your attention, feel the whole breath body. So it's a larger area. Not so focused, but still the awareness is the same. Now expand your attention, feel the whole body. Now listen to sound. And now expand your attention to the boundaries of the room. And then open attention without limit, up, down, all around. And witness change. So you can experiment with this. So I went from openness down into a really refined attention to the breath, And I opened out again. But to be able to do choiceless awareness is quite interesting. But sometimes you need to focus for a while to get grounded in the present moment. And then when there's a sense of being more sustained in the present moment, you might experiment and do this kind of open, not choosing. And this is the practice of anicca sanya, mindfulness with the perception of change. And if this doesn't work, then just pick up whatever practice works for you. Just another way to kind of explore meditation. So I'll be quiet and we'll sit quietly for the rest of this session. Okay. So you're entering your day, and I'm entering my night. So I'll say good morning to you and good night to me. And we'll see you in what? 11 hours, correct? Okay.
Good night,
everyone. Good night.